From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. For decades now, Republicans have wanted to implement voter ID laws at almost every level of government. And now, they may soon get what they've long pushed for. The Save America Act was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives last week. The measure requires proof of citizenship to register to vote across the country. The bill, backed by President Donald Trump, is now in the Senate, where Republicans are promising it will get a vote. Democrats, however, warn it will disenfranchise millions of Americans by making it harder to vote. So what does the legislation do? How big of a change is this for Nevada elections? And does the federal government even have the authority to tell states how to run elections? To get some of those answers, I've got Minnie Racker with me. She's the Nevada Independence correspondent in Washington, D.C. Minnie, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thanks, Paul. Glad to be here.
Talk to me about this legislation. What does it do?
So the bill basically does three things. One, it requires proof of citizenship to be able to register to vote. Two, it requires photo ID when you show up to vote. And three, it requires states to share their voter rolls with the Department of Homeland Security so they can cross-reference those with the folks who are and aren't eligible to vote.
Now, this bill was introduced in January of last year. Why are Republicans so eager to see it move now?
Well, I think, you know, we're entering an election year. We are not that far away. And things are not looking that good for Republicans across the country. You know, we've still got economic concerns. We've got a lot of Americans feeling uncomfortable with the Republican strategy on immigration enforcement. And so I think, one, Republicans are looking for an issue that is politically resonant. There's a lot of support for voter ID across the country. And so if Republicans get to say, hey, we're the ones who support showing an ID when you go to vote, that gives them a point in their column and an attack on Democrats. Another thing is, if this bill does not become law, it gives Republicans an excuse. They get to say, hey, because we didn't pass this bill, we have lots of non-citizens voting, and that's why we lost in the midterms.
Interesting. Supporters say the measure will ensure that non-citizens won't be able to vote in upcoming elections. First off, we know non-citizen voting in elections is not a major issue. A 2017 Brennan Center analysis of the 2016 election using data from 42 jurisdictions found that of the 23.5 million votes cast in those areas studied, there were only about 30 or so cases of non-citizens voting. So what is the administration's Republicans, what are they using as proof that undocumented people are voting?
Like you said, there's very little, I might even say no evidence that there's any significant kind of non-citizen voting going on in America. Like you said, there's a few sort of one-off cases that Republicans might point to. But I would say in general, it's more of a kind of hypothetical argument that Republicans and the White House are making. They're saying, look, we don't have as strict rules as some other countries, so it's possible that non-citizens could vote in America. The reality is that's just not happening. And even Republicans and conservative institutions will often acknowledge that's not happening.
Now, I've read criticism of the legislation that it would disenfranchise millions of women in particular, because documents like birth certificates don't include a married name. Is there any validity to those concerns?
I think there's a little bit of validity to that. You know, the bill does include provisions for people whose name does not match their birth certificate. There are some extra steps, especially women who've changed their name, can take to kind of verify their identity. But it does introduce that extra bureaucratic challenge. You know, for most people, if this law passed, you would have a birth certificate or a passport, and that's how you would prove you're a citizen. But if your name doesn't match your birth certificate, you're going to have to find other evidence to show that you are who you are. So I think it could kind of introduce some confusion for voters in getting all those documents together, and for the people who are actually going to be charged with enforcing this in making judgments about what constitutes actual proof of identity and citizenship.
Minnie, we got about a minute left. At this point, it appears the bill has the support of at least all the Republicans in the Senate, or at least most of them, meaning they have at least 50 votes. But the filibuster is still there. They'll need at least 60 to pass it. How do you see this playing out? Will it make it to the president's desk?
I think it's pretty unlikely that it's going to make it to the president's desk. We don't really have the appetite among Republicans here in Washington to nuke the filibuster to get this done. And Democrats are very strongly against it. So no, I don't think it's too likely to become law, but you know, we're gonna have to wait and see.
Minnie Racker is the Nevada Independent's Washington, D.C. correspondent. Minnie, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Paul.
It doesn't take long to read the Save America Act. It's only a few dozen pages, but the measure is dense and would likely upend elections in Nevada. To get a legal perspective on the legislation, I reached out to UNLV's Boyd School of Law. They recommended that I speak to Democratic Assembly member David Orentlicker, who teaches constitutional law as the Judge Jack and Lulu Lehman Professor of Law at the UNLV William S. Boyd School of Law and is director of the Health Law Program. Here's that conversation. Assemblymember Orentlicker, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
First, I want to get your impression on the legislation, the SAVE Act. You know, how much have you looked at this bill?
I've taken a pretty good look at it. And, you know, this is another example of a voting law or proposal that's addressing a non-existent problem or a barely existent problem and causing a lot of other problems that will actually make things much worse when it comes to election access and, you know, the quality of our election process. It's really going to undermine it. It would undermine it if it went into law.
Why do you say that? How so?
There are a few things. One is to ban universal voting by mail, which, you know, we've been doing now since 2020 and has really facilitated voting, and it would go back to the days when you have to have a reason for an absentee ballot. It would require that ballots be received by election day. When you do a mail ballot received by election day, we now allow 4 days after election day. And it would, you know, election officials already regularly review the election rolls to remove ineligible voters, people who have died, moved away, otherwise ineligible. They already do that. This require them to do it every 30 days. And that would raise the cost of administering elections without providing the funding. The provisions that have gotten the most attention and which will really interfere with the ability of eligible voters is voter ID, not only as we've already got a ballot initiative to require a photo ID, this would require proof that you are a citizen. In other words, you would need to bring a passport or your birth certificate when you vote. You know, I have a valid passport, but about half of Americans don't. And I'm not sure where my birth certificate is. And I think that's true for a lot of Americans. So according to estimates, more than 21 million Americans don't have ready access to a document that would be required to prove their citizenship. And we know from experience that this does create problems. Kansas illustrates this. They passed a law, a state version of this act, to require proof of citizenship. And before it was blocked by a federal district court, it was in effect for 2 years. And it prevented more than 31,000 people from registering, even though they were in fact eligible to vote. It's just the hurdle of demonstrating that you're a citizen blocked that. And that was 12% of the people who applied in that period to vote. So it creates real problems.
The federal government largely has stayed out of the elections game, leaving that to states over the last 250 years. This is a bit of a departure. I'm curious, in your legal opinion, do they actually have that authority to tell states what to do in this matter?
It is limited. You're right. It's a very important part of our system of federalism, that is the balance between state and federal power, because the framers were rightly worried about a federal government becoming too powerful. And so they reserved a lot of power to states, and running elections is for the most part for states. So if they tried to apply this act to state elections or local elections, courts would strike it down right away. So important, they've recognized that, the authors of this, so they're limiting it to federal elections. Now, even there, the states have the primary responsibility for administering federal elections, but the Constitution does allow Congress to regulate the times, places and manner of holding elections for members of Congress. So now that, what I've said so far explains why when President Trump tried to do this last year with an executive order, the court struck it down. Because mostly it's for states, and to the extent the federal government can get involved, it's got to be Congress, not the president. But now we do have Congress trying to do this. So they're within some realm of their authority. But another thing that comes in here is the right to vote in general. And while the court did uphold photo ID, 15 years ago, saying it didn't impose too great a burden on the ability to vote, having to show that your proof of citizenship raises it to a different level. If in Kansas 31,000 people were prevented from voting, that suggests that this kind of requirement goes too far, makes it too hard for eligible voters to vote. And that may lead the court to say it's unacceptable.
Democratic Assemblymember David Ortlicker of Las Vegas teaches constitutional law as the director of UNLV's health law program at the William S. Boyd School of Law. Assemblymember Ortlicker, thank you so much.
Sure thing.
Negotiations among the seven states that determine the Colorado River's future are still at an impasse. The guidelines that determine each state's current allotment of the river are set to expire at the end of 2026. Water managers for the seven states and dozens of tribes have been in negotiations in vain for years. That's part of the reason the Bureau of Reclamation set a February 14th target for negotiators to reach a deal. But nothing came of it. In a rare joint statement, the governors of California, Arizona, and Nevada said that the lower basin states remain firm and fair in their stance that all seven states must share responsibility for conservation. Northern basin states have largely been reluctant to make any cuts. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum previously said his agency would step in if states could not reach an agreement. So to get a better understanding of what's going on at the negotiating table, I spoke with John Ensminger. He's the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority and the Las Vegas Valley Water District. He's also Southern Nevada's lead negotiator at these talks. Here's what he had to say. John, it's good to have you back on the program.
Happy to be here.
Negotiators have been at it for years now, really. Why can't the upper basin and lower basin states come to some sort of agreement on how best to use the Colorado River?
I think the major impasse is the lower basin wants the upper basin to commit to more conservation. And for the amount of conservation the Upper Basin has put on the table, what they're asking for, which is a waiver of all of our compact claims, doesn't seem like a fair deal for us. All the other stuff, the operation of the upper initial units, the Palo-to-Meade release curve, shortages in the lower basin, there's several components of the deal that are near or are agreed to, but that fundamental, what are you giving us for what we're giving you is the impasse point.
Earlier this month, Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum called both the negotiators and governors of the seven states to Washington for talks. How did that go?
I thought it was a really good conversation. There were six governors in the room and a cabinet secretary in the room, and everybody professed that they don't want this to go to litigation. So I actually came out of that meeting fairly optimistic we could get somewhere. But then, absent a cabinet secretary and six governors, the seven negotiators, kind of wound up in the same place over the last couple of weeks.
There was some news outlets reporting that there was a possibility of at least a short-term deal. What happened to that?
I'd say that's still under discussion, and that may be where we end up. I mean, these negotiations are not over. Missing the deadline on Saturday didn't stop anybody from talking, because I talked to people on Sunday and Monday. So we're still having negotiations, but the ideal of a 20 or 30 year deal maybe turning into a can we come up with a 1, 2, 3, 5 year, operational agreement that sets aside some of the thornier issues.
This isn't the first time negotiations have blown past a deadline. This compact, those guidelines end at the end of the year. Play out the next few months for me. What happens now?
Well, I think the real deadline comes with the August 24-month study, because that dictates what the operations of the Colorado River will be next year. And without the 2007 guidelines in place, you need to know what is the release from Powell to Meade going to be? What are the releases from the upper initial units going to be? What are the water orders from lower basin contractors going to be? So you need answers to some very concrete questions in order to determine the plan of operation for water year 2027.
At what point do you think the feds will step in if negotiators can't come to some sort of deal?
Well, right now their plan is to, issue a record of decision, mid-summer, and that could, dictate, what they think the plan of operation is going to be, but it could also initiate litigation. So it's kind of an open-ended question.
If this does go to litigation, is this going to the Supreme Court? What would that litigation look like in your mind?
I think it'll be chaos for everybody, because I don't think it's one court. I think a record of decision gets challenged in federal district court, and who knows which district and which court of appeals. If there's a compact challenge, that's original jurisdiction litigation in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not one litigation in one court. It's multifaceted.
Would this be something, sort of like arbitration, between, like a union or an employer, where essentially the courts are going to look at the bottom line and make a judgment and no one's going to be happy? Or is this going to be more just years and years of the state suing each other?
As a recovering attorney, my experience is very seldom is anybody completely happy coming out of litigation. So everybody will probably have something to be unhappy about. But at the end of the day, some set of humans are going to have to decide how to operate the system, regardless of whether this is a 1 year or 20 year litigation period. Somebody still has to decide how to release water, from, Lake Powell down to Lake Meade, who gets to take what. And I think one of the fundamental things we're dealing with right now is whether we want the seven states to continue to have our hands on that steering wheel, or whether we're going to turn that over to a federal court or a special master to make that decision for us.
This year's snowpack is looking abysmal. The Bureau of Reclamation has already been revising its annual water flow through the Colorado River estimations down since December. Some experts are seriously concerned that, this might be one of those years where, we might actually get to a point where they stop being able to, generate electricity through Lake Powell. Is that something you're concerned about this year?
Well, I'm certainly concerned about the snowpack this year. It does not look good. I don't think losing hydropower at Powell this year is a significant concern, because of the amount of water in the upper initial units, Flaming Gorge, Blue Mesa, Navajo. There's enough water upstream of Powell to protect 3490 this year, which is the elevation that you would lose hydropower generation from. But the snowpack's not good, and Broncos game against the Patriots aside, the winter has not been great for water supplies.
I know it's kind of all theory at this point, but what happens to Las Vegas and Southern Nevada's water supply if you get to a point where the river stops flowing?
Well, first of all, we've installed $1.5 billion in infrastructure so that, we have the lowest intake in Lake Mead. If Lake Mead got to Deadpool, which is the elevation where you can't release water downstream from Lake Mead to, 25 million-ish people in Arizona, California, and Mexico, there's still 10 years of water supply in Lake Mead, for Nevada to, maintain the safety of our community. But I do believe things will be put in place that water is going to keep flowing through the Grand Canyon. I know things are dire, but all of the climate scientists I've listened to, all of the hydrologists I've listened to, I don't believe water not flowing, through the Grand Canyon is a realistic scenario. So I think Las Vegas is and will remain the most water secure city in the desert Southwest.
When this used to be a call-in program, this would be the point where we would get somebody who would talk about desalination in California. And you would talk about how that's prohibitively expensive, incredibly energy demanding. Instead, SNWA has invested a lot in helping Southern California water districts conserve, recycle water. How are those efforts going?
They're going well. Our board has already approved $750 million to invest in Pure Water, which is a Metropolitan Water District of Southern California project to take all of the wastewater that they're currently discharging into the Pacific Ocean, treat it, and use it to recharge their aquifers in Southern California. And in return for that, we get a piece of that water left in Lake Mead. So there's some really innovative supply side options that are moving forward. And I'm not anti-desal. I think you just have to be, open with the public about what those costs are. Like we, for us, on a wholesale basis, we charge about $350 an acre foot to deliver water to our member agencies. Desalinated water costs about $2,200. So, you can do it, but it's going to come at a cost to your ratepayers.
At what point do you all start looking for new sources of water? At this point, are there conversations about restarting, I don't know, things like the Eastern Nevada pipeline or other projects like that?
Well, our 50-year resource plan that we do every single year, so we always have a fresh 5-decade outlook and includes the shortages we expect to take, in face of the drought on the Colorado River, includes the Pure Water Project, but also shows that we don't really need new supplies, through the 2070s, other than the Pure Water Project. So no, we're not looking at new importation projects, but I think folks in Arizona and, other parts of the basin may well be.
What are some things that at this point, when you're reading reports, when you're talking to people who don't have these conversations on a daily basis, what do you think they're getting right and what do you think they're getting wrong about these negotiations?
I guess the main thing is, I think a lot of the reporting, seems to think there's a cliff, right? That if the states don't come to an agreement, that there's some sort of, catastrophe. Whereas in reality, again, people will make decisions. Somebody's going to be operating Glen Canyon Dam. Somebody's going to be operating Hoover Dam in 2027, regardless of whether there's a deal or not. And if there's court cases, there will be court cases. But there will be a plan of operation. So I'm not advocating for uncertainty. I think the main reason for the seven states to be at the table is to have certainty around our operations. But one way or another, water will be delivered, and we'll live within our means, whatever those are.
John Ensminger is the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority and the Las Vegas Valley Water District. John, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
In November 2000, then-President Bill Clinton signed the Tembisha Shoshone Homeland Act into law. Among other provisions, it returned ancestral land to the tribe, including a parcel in Death Valley National Park. Now, 25 years later, the tribe is celebrating the passage of the act. However, that celebration comes as the Department of the Interior is reviewing signage at the park's visitor center that mentions the tribe. KNPR's Jimmy Romo has more.
More than 50 Tembisha Shoshone tribal members and supporters are marching down the main road in Furnace Creek towards the Death Valley National Park Visitor Center. That includes Jimmy John Thompson, Tembisha Shoshone council member.
We have 317 acres here within Death Valley National Park where we continue to live. And we want to make that statement. We are still here.
He's part of a demonstration honoring the passage of the Tembisha Shoshone Homeland Act. It returned five parcels of ancestral land to the tribe. While most of their sovereign land is in Nevada, one parcel is within the national park. He's proud of those five parcels of land.
Tembisha is one of the only tribal nations in this country who was able to sue the Department of Interior and get trust lands within a national park. We have 300.
Originally, the tribe planned to hold a ribbon cutting for the updated exhibit inside the park's visitor center, celebrating the 25-year anniversary of the passage of the Homeland Act. Instead, the celebration turned into a protest when the Department of Interior placed the signage under review. That's because President Trump signed an executive order last March asking the Department of the Interior to remove all signage that inappropriately disparages Americans. So far, the department has removed signage at 17 national parks. In those cases, the signage included language that described slavery, climate change, and Native American history, according to Outside. In Death Valley, phrases like, "This is our homeland," prompted the review. Thompson says he doesn't understand the problem.
Like I stated before, we have a display there currently. They want us to change the language in it. They wanted us not to use the words homeland, even though the name of our act is Homeland Act.
For some, removing the signage is yet another effort to erase their past. Before the Homeland Act went into effect, the federal government considered the Tembisha Shoshone squatters on the land. And in a place where 140 days a year are at or above 100 degrees, many who live there migrated to nearby mountains during the summer. According to the tribe's secretary treasurer, George Golson, the Park Service would use that opportunity to remove any signs of them from the area.
Well, after they left, then the park would literally come in with a water hose and wash the house away.
Golson says the relationship between the tribe and the park services at the time was tumultuous at best.
As a race, we hid. We had to hide. Like my mom, she moved us away from the reservation because she didn't want us treated like she was treated. So we moved out into a different area. And I think that culturally, we had to hide some of our stuff from being destroyed.
That relationship has since changed. It's now been 25 years since the Tembisha Shoshone regained the right of their homelands and no longer have to worry about the government tampering with their homes. That's part of the reason why the Tembisha Shoshone people chose to celebrate the act becoming law now. Thompson says it's unfortunate that those who worked so hard to see the land returned weren't able to see how far the tribe has come since then.
When they did this, they were elders themselves 25 years ago. So unfortunately, most of them are no longer with us. And that saddens me, honestly, to know that we did not get this completed while they were still here. They did
not get that. Their work has not gone forgotten. Thompson doesn't live on the reservation, but he visits as often as he can with his daughter and grandkids. He says it's important that the land feels like home to them, even when he's gone.
I always feel like I'm home when I come here. Like I told my kids and my grandkids, kick your shoes off. Go walk out in that sand. Leave your footprint. Your footprint now mingles with your ancestors. They're here, you're here.
Thompson says the tribe will use this renewed focus on the land regained through the Homeland Act to build 50 new homes on the reservation. He says they're also looking to develop economic opportunities that capitalize on the 2 million tourists who visit Death Valley National Park and the Tembisha Shoshone homelands every year. Jimmy Romo, KNPR News.
Imagine an arts and culture hub where you could see a play one night and an opera concert the next, and then watch a movie at home that was filled at said hub. Well, Las Vegas may soon get such a place. Third Street is a multi-venue, multidisciplinary campus planned for the old downtown cinemas complex. It won't just host multiple performance spaces. It will feature many spaces for film and other media creation. It also aims to educate and train the next generation of local creatives. KNPR's Mike Privat recently spoke with Third Street CEO Daz Weller, also the artistic director of Vegas Theater Company, and COO Ginger Land Van Buren, who also serves as executive director of Vegas City Opera. Here's that conversation.
Ginger and Daz, welcome to State of Nevada.
Well, hello, thanks.
Hi, Mike.
Why is it important to have an arts hub like Third Street in our community?
Why not? I mean, this is such an opportunity for our community. You know, I've been running Vegas City Opera for the last, it's almost 17 years now. And to have a place where a company like this can grow, be supported, be joined by other incredible organizations, have the kind of spaces that Third Street's going to offer, and the kind of support is going to be really, truly incredible, with an artistic vision that is really encompassing a lot of education as well. It's truly something that I think the nation's going to look at.
I'm glad you said that, because I was wondering if other cities and their arts industries have benefited from having a similar campus.
I don't believe so. I think this is one of the very first. I know that we're turning an 8 cinema multiplex into this arts and media incubator, but this is truly the first of its kind in the nation.
We're bringing a lot of different disciplines under one roof. And so I think you'll see other models in other cities like Z-Space in San Francisco and OpenJAR in New York City that do similar things, but without all the disciplines under one roof. And then this very robust workforce training and education piece that we're also bringing to the table.
Now, as far as what's not in Las Vegas currently, what do you think Third Street will provide that will be fresh and new to the community?
What we're missing, the problem we're trying to solve, is to really build some mid-sized spaces. We have a lot of really terrific young companies who are working out of small spaces. But what do you do when you need to grow an idea? We had the perfect example of this at Vegas Theater Company. A few years ago, we did the world premiere of a new musical called The House on Watch Hill, written by Richard Oberacker. The season sold out our 80-seat theater. There was nowhere to extend it into, to kind of build on the momentum that we'd garnered. And so we said goodbye to that project. And so there's projects like this happening all over the city in all different disciplines. So what we're trying to solve with Third Street is building a 250-seat space, a 150-seat space, and then eventually in phase two get to a 600-seat space so that we can take these ideas, really incubate new ideas and Vegas companies and grow them so that there is a stepping stone up to those big cultural houses that we have one of in the Smith Center.
What might this facility do for Vegas City Opera?
It's going to be able to give us a platform to really expand our presentations. We are kind of an immersive avant-garde company that creates our own pieces of operatic work, and be able to present this platform and expand an audience, invent new pieces of work, and create stuff that is truly for our Vegas audience and in different spaces. We've been sort of limited on, you know, working with the city of Las Vegas in their spaces, working with the libraries, working with the Winchester. So now we get to have these beautiful spaces and create new works inside them that will adapt for what we want to create, not being sort of limited to creating what is in the space that we have.
We're a city of 2.5 million people, and we're kind of unique in the nation in that we do not have the cultural infrastructure that other cities of our size have. And so Third Street is looking to kind of expand on that infrastructure and really build a city that, you know, as we build out these kind of other entertainment infrastructure in the city with the Sphere and these amazing sporting facilities, that we do the same with our cultural infrastructure. So we like to see ourselves as the next piece of that cultural expansion.
there's a lot happening in this facility that's planned. You mentioned some of those things earlier, workforce development, the venues. What else rounds out the Third Street experience?
On paper, we're building spaces. So we're a venue. We're building mid-sized spaces. We're also a home for resident companies so that we can incubate them. The one-word mission for the place is incubation. We're incubating our people, our stories, our small organizations. And so apart from building space, bringing in resident companies, we're bringing in an education piece. But part of the model is that we also make the space available to other organizations within the city. And so there'll be subsidized rates for other arts organizations and film and media organizations to participate. And also there'll be rates available for people who want to rent our space for weddings, parties, the corporate sector. You know, part of what we're building in terms of the financial model, you look at arts institutions around the country, and anyone that is healthy is relying on an operating budget that takes in 40 to 60% contributed income, meaning donations, sponsorships, grants. Vegas doesn't fund arts organizations to that capacity. So rather than trying to change the philanthropic model and get to 40% contributed, we're looking to get to 20% contributed and make up the rest through earned income. So it's unique in that sense. The other piece that we're building out that no one really has is a streaming platform. And so we're looking at a distribution platform that doesn't really come into play until years 5 to 7. But making sure that you can come in with a physical product, leave with a digital product that can then be distributed through Third Street so that we expand our audience, not just here in Las Vegas, but nationally and maybe even across the world.
Sounds like a good segue, Ginger. I'm wondering, how much will this all cost?
Right now, we've launched our capital campaign, which is looking at a $7 million raise, of which we are at about $500,000 right now. But we're looking to sort of wrap this all up at the end of the year and be able to really go into our construction phase, which we'll be excited about.
What we're trying to do is prove the model. I mean, I don't even know if Vegas wants this. And so rather than going, we're going to launch a $40 million campaign to build this building, this is a humble campaign to test the model. It's not a build it and they will come idea. From my perspective, there is demand for this. If we look at what the Smith Center has done in terms of building their audience base, when they programmed Hamilton, they got 13,000 subscribers. We need 12 to 15% of that audience to cross over into what we're doing. So 12 to 15% of that audience who says, we are interested in an off-Broadway style product. And I think that exists, but it's still yet to be proven. And so let's make the spaces, create the programming, create the workforce pieces so that we're also supporting and augmenting an education system that we're seeing right now is being cut dramatically. And it's always the arts programs that go first. And we know that arts education is essential to the future of our workforce. Those soft skills, communication, collaboration, storytelling, problem solving, they're things that employers want and they're things that we teach in arts education.
Ginger, I got to ask you, how do you make the big pitch for the money? You know, I hate to use the phrase, but I imagine there are investors out there who might be like, well, what's the return on investment? So what do you tell them in the pitch?
Las Vegas is sort of at a turning point, right? We've got 8,000, I think, apartments coming online, condos right downtown. We've got this huge surge of the arts district happening, and we can lose all of the culture that's happening right now downtown. We can sort of get, you know, lost in this transition of investment and buildings, or we can really invest in our people and our community and our stories and the legacy of what we want to build right now and who we are. And this building will do that for us.
Daz, you've signed a 31-year lease for the building. You mentioned earlier you're not sure if Vegas will even go for this. So I got to ask, if somehow you don't raise the $7 million to launch Third Street, is there a possibility Third Street doesn't happen?
The great thing that we've built in is that the model is scalable. So we can scale up and we can scale down. We have very supportive partners in our landlord who have given us not only very good terms on our lease, but a runway that'll see us. It's not until year 5 where we begin paying full retail rent on the building. And by that point, we've also built into our lease the option to purchase. The plan is to buy the building. And I think we're on track to do that. We're talking to fundraisers in San Francisco and Boston who are coming on board to help us reach that capital piece of what we're doing because they're super excited about this. But worst case scenario, if we don't hit those those numbers, then we scale back.
You'll have multiple amenities for film production at Third Street. I'm wondering, how will you work with the film industry, whether it's the one here or the one out of state, to get that participation and business into Third Street?
So we're pursuing a number of pathways at the moment. We're talking with the film school at UNLV and also the film school through CSN. There's a number of festivals. I mean, there's so many festivals that need space and homes to show their works.
Third Street will have a gradual rollout, as Daz kind of mentioned earlier. There'll be some amenities that'll be available to the public as early as this year. Completion is scheduled for 2028. And then I saw there was mention of Third Street's inaugural season. So with your company and Daz's company, there's Las Vegas Sinfonietta that'll also be a resident company. I'm wondering what an inaugural season might look like, and when would it begin?
So we're really looking at a 28 season, right, for our inaugural season. The most complete, exciting season, offerings from all of the pillar companies, but then also, you know, we're inviting in every other organization in the community, and we're going to do this sort of pitch fest, which we haven't mentioned either, where we'll be able to take ideas from the community and other organizations and incorporate them in our season as well.
We're really trying to reverse the model. Arts institutions are often built as these temples to art that are programmed from up on high, and we, the patrons, come and feed from the trough of art. And we really want to reverse the narrative on that and make Third Street a place that reaches out and asks the question, who are you? What stories do you want to tell? What are you making right now? And how can we make space for that to happen? And so students who are here in Las Vegas can look around at the cultural infrastructure here and go, oh, I am welcome here. I belong here. There is a place for my voice to be heard.
Ginger Land Van Buren is the COO of Third Street, a planned professional arts multi-venue facility for downtown Las Vegas. Daz Weller is the CEO of the forthcoming campus. Ginger and Daz, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Here to filter out a few of the best options is KNPR senior producer Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
The Lunar New Year began yesterday, February 17th. It typically goes on for 15 days. For those who want to celebrate, what events do you recommend?
Well, there is a lot going on over the next 2 weeks. In fact, events have already been happening. I would like to highlight something that is on Sunday, February 22nd, and that's the Spring Festival at Desert Breeze Park, just west of Chinatown. This is a free 3-hour daytime festival, and this is a more community-minded affair than what you'll see elsewhere, especially on the Strip.
I think there's a belief that a lot of the events for Lunar New Year are just gambler bait.
Right. This Spring Festival is squarely for locals, although, of course, anybody can come. There's a lot going on at this festival. I think the main attraction is the outdoor stage, and it's packed with performers. They've got singers, fan dancers, drum groups, Shaolin martial artists. You also have student groups and adult organizations that hail from many different East Asian nationalities. So this is not just a celebration of Chinese culture. There's workshops and games and arts and crafts opportunities for those who want to get hands-on. And then you have the requisite food and merchandise vendors. And, you know, the county doesn't have to go far to find solid Asian dining participants given where this has taken place. And this is all happening on February 22nd.
Finally, two art exhibits in their final weeks. What are they?
Well, for the first, Las Vegas artist and arts advocate Nancy Good is winding down her 2-month-long exhibit at Whitney Library. It's called From What Do My Wandering Eyes Do Appear? And I feel like the exhibit's webpage probably says it best. Quote, this exhibition explores the hidden elements of the natural world, including human biology, to reveal our interconnectedness with each other and the planet. Viewers are invited to see what's beyond what the eye typically allows. And I take that to mean that Good is using the physical, the technological, and the metaphysical to demonstrate what it's like to be human and to be human with one another.
All right, I think I'm having a hard time imagining this. What should people expect?
Well, so a few of the works I was able to look at, they almost look 3D. Good is using different paints, painting approaches, and even collage. And she's also using different colors. Some are very bright, and they kind of all together have a pop-out effect when employed. Also, there are these patterns and sinewy lines that are waving throughout the works, and some of them look kind of arterial. And one work has these sort of like blobs of circles that look cellular. This is all to say it's kind of easy to see the physiology of the exhibition, even in abstracted form. This exhibition closes on February 24th.
And you've got until February 20th, that's Friday, to catch this other recommendation. What is it?
It's over at UNLV's Grant Hall Gallery. It's a group show with a very interesting theme. The show is called She Will Be Hearing From Me Tonight, and the theme is awkward. Specifically, this show explores the desperate and perhaps inappropriate ways that people end a relationship.
That sounds like it could be risque.
Yeah, this could be the stuff of rom-com movies and Taylor Swift songs, but these six artists, they do seem to be taking things a little further. The show specifically mines all the embarrassing and obsessive and desperate gestures that folks make when they are trying to get the attention of someone who's already moved on. And I feel like Gen Z has culturally reinforced the need to respect boundaries. And this show seems to be what happens when the heart rebels against that. And despite this being closing night, the opening reception is actually on February 20th.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we have this week, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paul.